Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Good evening, everyone. If you enjoy our show and find our research both interesting and informative, please can I ask that you consider leaving us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does help us out a huge amount. You can also find out more about us and our work by heading over to deadsouls.co.uk and checking us out. We are a small team of 3 researchers with more than 70 years of experience between us. You can also find us and speak to us over on Instagram. Just search Dead Souls Social Club and we'll come up. So, as always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is The Iranian Embassy Siege, Part 3. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight.
Chapter 5, Running Out of Time.
4 days into the siege, and Salim was growing increasingly frustrated. All of the hostages were herded up to the 3rd floor and pushed into the reference library. The room was fairly boxy and roughly 20 feet in length and 15 feet wide. The gunman piled the chairs and tables against the windows facing the front of the building, creating a barricade in case anyone tried to enter the building. Salim announced, "Listen everybody, if the police try to storm the building, we have no choice but to kill all Iranian hostages." He seemed anxious. Ali beckoned all of the women into the corridor with him and told them, quote, "This is a safe place for you, in case the police decide to attack. Don't go near the windows, there are bombs, and don't touch a thing," Faisal barked. Out of all the terrorists, Faisal, Salim's second in command, seemed the most ready and willing to carry out the group's threats. He was quiet, moody, and always seemed angry. Salim and Faisal created a circle of newspapers on the floor in the center of the room. They told each of the Iranian hostages to sit inside it. PC Trevor Locke later said of this, quote, "It was as if they planned to machine gun them in close proximity. Completely sinister." The gunmen were braced for an assault. Salim snapped at PC Locke, "If your police attack, we will kill you." "The police will not attack. You're in England. We don't do things like that. If you don't hurt us, then the police won't hurt you. All they want is for this to end peacefully," Locke calmly replied. Salim left the room. The air was thick with tension. The gunman's paranoia was beginning to seep into the psyche of the hostages. Salim re-entered the room and announced, quote, "We are now negotiating with the police, and the police have explained these complicated matters take some time. We decided to extend the deadline." Salim had seemingly backed down from his threats. He seemed calm and reasonable again. In the first hours of the siege, he had seemed so certain and focused of both his plans and his timetable of events. Locke and some of the other hostages suspected that he was starting to waver. "We are giving the Iranian government until 2 p.m. today. This is not a sign of weakness, but out of humanitarian duty. After 2 p.m, all responsibility falls upon the Iranian government. If the Iranian government will acknowledge that they are negotiating with the British government, then we will extend the time," Salim announced. But the 2 p.m. deadline came and went. Nothing had changed. Salim picked up the field telephone and told the police that he would extend the deadline until 4:30, if the police would reconnect the telephones. "If not, the responsibility will be with the police," Salim asserted. At 4:45, Salim was back on the field telephone. He read out to the negotiators a new list of demands. "We want 1. an aircraft to fly my group and Iranian hostages to the Middle East. The British hostages will be released at the airport. 2. The ambassadors of Iraq, Algeria and Jordan to mediate, and the Red Cross representative must be waiting for us at the airport. 3. The crew of the aircraft should comprise of mainly females. 4. A coach with curtained windows to transport us and the hostages to the airport. Finally, Salim firmly asserted, "This is our final demand, and if it is not met by 7 p.m, the hostages will be executed." This was beginning to get repetitive. But it was the police negotiator's job to just drag the situation out. To keep buying time. Keep wearing the terrorists down. In all reality, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher could not and would not be flexible and not authorise any of the terrorist demands to be granted. Chief Dello and Zulu Base were aware of this, and they just tried to placate the gunmen as much as they could. They certainly had no chance of getting out of the country. In all likelihood, their chance of even getting out of the building was slim at best. It's notable that by this juncture, the terrorists had stopped demanding the release of the 91 prisoners in Iranian jails, something they were insistent upon in their initial communication of requirements to police. Maybe the terrorists had come to the acceptance, or realization at least, that Iran is likely to grant that wish. More so, that Great Britain had very little control in getting Iran to do it anyway. In fact, when it was originally communicated to Iran that's what the terrorists were demanding, the Iranian foreign minister had responded with expected belligerence. What the terrorists didn't know was that the UK security services had received reports from Iran that some Arabs held in Iranian jails had already been executed in retaliation for the embassy siege. Tehran had issued a statement to the British government too, which was allegedly signed by 10 of the jailed Arabs. Supposedly, the Arabs had said that they did not want the government of Iran to agree to the terrorist demands and that they would prefer to remain in prison. If you believe this, then I have a bridge to sell you. The communication had either been extracted under torture or had been entirely invented by Tehran's propaganda machine. On a side note, the new request that Salim had made, which included bringing Iraq's ambassador into the negotiations, seemed to be very suspicious. By this point, MI6 had received intel that the terrorists had been recruited and trained by Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Was all this a plot by the Iraqi leader? Was Saddam hoping to be invited to step in and resolve the situation? And what was the end game here? Meanwhile, and what the terrorists didn't know, was that directly next door, Major Hector Gullen of the SAS was busy working on a series of plans that he didn't expect to realistically have to implement. Whilst many operations were executed against terrorist targets, special ops were always the absolute last resort. They often went weeks or months planning operations only to ultimately be stood down again and again. The SAS B squadron had been back home in the UK for around 2 months. They had spent the preceding 5 months in Northern Ireland, engaged in counter-terrorism operations against the IRA. The period had been one of the deadliest and bloodiest periods of the Troubles. Just 8 months prior, Lord Louis Mountbatten, the Queen's cousin, had been assassinated while sailing with his family off the Irish coast. The IRA had planted a 50-pound gelignite bomb on his boat. It happened on the same day that a roadside bomb was detonated by the Irish Republican Army at Warren Point in County Down. 18 soldiers of the British Army's Parachute Regiment were killed, including its commanding officer. The two SAS teams, Red and Blue, each rotated in 12-hour shifts. One team would be next door to the embassy in full combat gear and fully equipped with weaponry, ready to deploy if the order was given. The second team rested, slept, ate and waited at Regent's Park Barracks. Initial plans for hostage rescue options had been drawn up. Commander Gullen had to take into account a number of factors in preparing this, namely, any incoming intelligence, reconnaissance, equipment, building layout, available troops, presumed location of hostages, location of the gunmen, enemy weaponry, access points, sniper positions, surveillance information, and police points. More than anything, the utmost secrecy was essential. In fact, nobody outside Zulu Base and the Government Cobra Committee even knew that the SAS had even been spoken with, let alone them actually being at the location and ready to strike at a moment's notice. The hordes of press outside would have had a field day if they knew, not to mention how the terrorists would have reacted. The building was a maze of rooms structured in the shape of a letter H, if you can imagine it in your mind's eye. There was a section of flat roof forming the bar connecting the two sides. There were separated balconies which ran along the front of the building at the first floor, and also balconies that ran along the second floor at the rear of the building. The centre of the building was an empty void. It had a sort of well between the first and third floors. At the bottom was a four-sided skylight, essentially a pyramid of glass which illuminated the ground floor hallway below it. The plan that was put together also had to take into account potential casualties, fire hazards, and evacuation routes. When the SAS commander had heard the gunman had demanded a bus to transport them to the airport for passage out of the country, he considered a plan to ambush the bus on the way to Heathrow Airport, on a route cleared of all civilians. This was too risky, however, and far more variables than a contained building. Up until this point, the soldiers in the regiment simply referred to their planning as Operation Salim, after the lead gunman, obviously. But as the siege dragged on, and the likelihood of the SAS having to intervene, an official and formal plan for the action was required. An Old Testament ruler who was described in the Bible as, quote, a mighty hunter before the Lord, who was featured in both Jewish and Muslim traditions. A ruler who confronts Abraham in a cataclysmic battle between good and evil. He was named Nimrod, the Hunter King. Thus, the SAS operation to hunt down the terrorists and free the hostages was now officially named Operation Nimrod. The SAS were on standby and prepared to deploy within an instant. The team were armed with a compact Heckler & Koch MP5 submachine gun, the regiment's preferred weapon. The low muzzle velocity of the MP5 meant that, instead of passing through a body, the rounds tended to explode inside it, inflicting greater damage. It was also able to fire 13 rounds per second. Light, accurate, and extremely lethal. Each soldier carried 4 magazines with 30 rounds apiece. They were full metal jacketed 9x19mm Parabellum bullets in each magazine. Fun fact, Parabellum is derived from the Latin meaning, if you seek peace, prepare for war. Further, each soldier also carried a Browning semi-automatic 9mm pistol in holster, which had a magazine capacity of 13 rounds. The SAS chose to only use 12, however. This avoided causing a jam and was also kinder on the spring. The Browning had to be cocked before you fired the first round, so the SAS carried the weapon ready cocked with the safety catch on. This made quick draw and fire a simple motion. Firearms aside, some of the most important elements in the SAS toolkit were their tools for surprise and concealment. The soldiers would deploy tear gas, nerve agents, and stun grenades, what they called thunder and lightning. They purpose to poison, blind, deafen, and disorient any opponent. The G60 flashbang, which they carried, was developed by Royal Ordnance at Enfield. Developed specifically to a specification provided by the SAS, the device was composed of mercury and magnesium powder. A tasty concoction which creates a 300,000 candle power blinding flash upon detonation. A burst of light so bright that it causes a few seconds of total blindness, followed by blurred or double vision for several minutes. A hell of a surprise if you aren't expecting it. The volume of the bang upon detonation rings at 160 decibels, which induces temporary deafness, also causing loss of balance. The effect was instant and significant. Loss of hearing and sight, mixed with dizziness, disorientation, and nausea. All in a split second. CS gas, or tear gas, was developed at Porton Down, the top-secret Ministry of Defence Science and Technology laboratory in the 1950s. The main element in its mixture is a cyanocarbon, which causes significant irritation of the eyes, irritation of the nose, mouth, and throat. Nasal discharge, sneezing, coughing, vomiting, and a restriction to your breathing. If you are on the receiving end, the effects can last anywhere from a few minutes to a few months. Then there is CR gas, or fire gas. It's similar to CS gas, but far more nasty. Developed at the Ministry of Defence's Porton Down lab in the 1960s, it's a small package of pure hell, causing extreme coughing, temporary blindness, panic, and acute skin irritation. It can feel like your skin is on fire, and with it, you simply cannot catch any air to breathe. It can actually kill a human through asphyxiation and pulmonary edema if the area it's set off in isn't suitably ventilated. Finally, the soldiers are also equipped with L-29s, another stun device about the size of a tin of soup. It kicks out enough gas and smoke to temporarily blacken a room, removing the option of your opponent seeing where the hell he is. As an SAS operative, it's great to hide within. The regiment have specially adapted CR canisters, enabling them to be fired from a handheld launcher accurate to 200 feet also. Each soldier wears an S6 respirator gas mask worn under a black rubber NBC, or Nuclear, Biological and Chemical Hood, which is attached to a black polyester overall or type of boiler suit to my American friends. Over this is a Kevlar vest with additional ceramic plates for increased armour. The kit is rounded off with standard issue army boots and a knife sheathed in the vest at the shoulder. Balaclavas are usually worn under the gas masks for additional anonymity. The outfit was completed by a pair of thin green leather aviator gloves which fit over the hands like an extra layer of skin. A man wearing all of this, armed and emerging from gas, smoke and through your tears, with a harsh blast of heat and incredible noise, would appear absolutely terrifying, without a doubt. Attacking a 56-room building would be incredibly difficult, and the SAS team knew this. Intelligence had shown that the gunmen had already placed barricades in place. They also suspected that booby traps had likely been laid throughout the building. The terrorists would be braced for an attack, without a doubt. In both the Cobra Committee briefing room and back at Zulu base, an intense debate raged as to whether Salim's demands and statement should be broadcast on the national news. This was something that Salim desired over all else, and he was very clear in his demand for the coverage. Commissioner Della was steadfast that this should only be granted in return for the clearest concessions, in his words. There could be no national or international impression that Britain was in any way bending to the needs of the terrorists. However, Dello also feasted on the food for thought that if the statement was suppressed, or only broadcast in part, there is the risk of the gunmen following through on their numerous and repeated threats to kill a hostage. Back at the embassy, tensions were running high. They were at boiling point, in fact, and Salim was in a fit of rage. His frustration at not yet hearing his demands and statement on the radio only inflamed things, and he was convinced the police were lying to him, stringing him along. But, as Dello finally instructed the negotiators to inform Salim that the police had made a formal request to the BBC to broadcast the statement, Salim was getting what he wanted, but he still refused to believe it. All of the hostages were told to place their hands behind their heads and were shepherded back into the third floor reference library. There was chaos. The gunmen were shouting, the hostages were screaming, crying, and generally anxious wrecks by now. Sim Harris, the remaining BBC journalist, was concerned that there would be a cock-up somewhere along the line, in his words. He suggested that he be allowed to call the police to find out which radio station the statement would be broadcast on. Salim liked this idea and agreed. Trying to appease Salim, Harris told him, quote, "You're winning, Salim. Just stay calm. The broadcast is going to be made and you're getting there. Radio 1, Radio 2 and the BBC World Service had confirmed that they would be running the statement, and the police negotiator confirmed this to Sim Harris on the field telephone. "Let's hope the broadcast appeased the terrorists," Harris thought. SAS B Squadron braced again for action. If the broadcast didn't appease the gunmen, the situation could escalate quickly. MI5, Zulu Base, and the SAS listened in to the chatter in the embassy. They could hear the terrorists and hostages gathered and tuning through radio stations searching for the broadcast. The fizz of static filled the air. Faisal, Abbas and Hassan were stood around the room, faces determined and fixed on the hostages. The tension was excruciating. PC Locke stared at the ceiling, clenching and unclenching his fists, sweat streaming down his face. There was no telling what was about to happen, he thought. Just then, static clearing, there was an announcement on the radio. "This is the BBC World Service. We are interrupting our programme to go over to the scene at the Iranian embassy siege in London, where there has been a dramatic development." The gunman neared the radio to hear more clearly. "We swear to God and the British government," the statement began. The room erupted in joy. Sim Harris actually hugged Salim and exclaimed, "You've won, Salim, you've won. It's being broadcast word for word. It's fantastic." A fairly good effort at appeasement. There was a general joviality in the room. Hostage takers and hostages themselves laughed and cheered. The tension immediately dissipated. The gunmen had their statement broadcast, and the hostages felt relief that they were content, at least for now. Several of the gunmen were in tears. Hard-faced Faisal was stood sobbing. The jubilation could be clearly heard on the audio probes. The SAS stood back a level, and Zulu Base and the intelligence services let out a heavy sigh of relief. "I am going to release another hostage," Salim said. Initially, everyone would assume a woman would be released. But the lucky soul would be Ali Guil Ganzafar, a Pakistani tourist who was in the embassy at the time of the attack applying for a visa. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Ganzafar was an eccentric man. Both the gunman and the other hostages felt this way. He kept insisting that he be set free to catch a plane that he had bought a ticket for the following week. He seemed more of the opinion that the hostage situation was an inconvenience rather than a life or death situation. But he got what he wanted, although Salim said after his release that the main reason he was let go was because of his infuriatingly loud snoring and hogging of the food that the police had sent in. As you'll recall, PC Trevor Locke had kept his firearm hidden during the raid on the embassy. He had spent the time inside, fearful that the gun would be discovered, and to ensure that he wasn't, he kept his sweater and overcoat on the entire time. He also hadn't been to the toilet in over 4 days, scared that if he went, the gunman, who would certainly escort him to the facilities, would find the gun on him. This meant Locke stank. The sweat and tension, plus the warmth inside the embassy, had caused Locke to emit levels of bodily odour that was hard to ignore by the gunmen or the other hostages. But that night, with the terrorists in high spirits, Locke finally asked to go to the toilet at 3 a.m, thinking they would be too tired to want to search and monitor him at this time and point. He was right. Although Locke had to convince Faisal that he had a bad case of embarrassing flatulence and was quote-unquote backed up, so privacy would be appreciated. Faisal agreed, and Locke was finally able to take a massive shit and have a body and hair wash in the sink. He felt refreshed and relieved, then re-hid his gun under his sweater. "It's time to move back upstairs to the room you were all in on the second floor," Ali politely announced. "Please collect all of your coats, jackets and cushions." The intention was to keep the hostages moving around the building to confuse the police outside as to what was going on in the building and also make them unsure as to where everyone was in the event that they decided to try and storm the place. Ambassadors from the Middle East had expressed a willingness to mediate, and the Red Cross was standing by to help if required. comments made on Radio 4 said. This is something positive, both the gunman and hostages thought. Salim was happy that the authorities were finally taking his demands seriously.
Chapter 6. Stalemate.
It was now the fifth day of the siege. The UK Foreign Office had been holding numerous talks with the diplomats from Arabian countries, with the hope being that they could be persuaded to go to the embassy and negotiate with the terrorists. 7 Arab ambassadors were contacted, and 4 had agreed to discuss the situation with Douglas Hurd, the UK Minister of State at the Foreign Office. The 4 were namely the Kuwaiti, Jordanian, Algerian, and Syrian ambassadors. The talks ultimately ended in stalemate, however. The diplomats were insistent on being able to offer passage out of the UK for the gunmen. The UK government, though, were firm with their insistence that no terrorists would be allowed out of the country. They would either be taken into police custody or killed. Those were the only two options that Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's government would be willing to consider. In a tone-deaf and entirely inflammatory move, the Iranian government then suddenly released the following statement to the press, and more specifically, the hostages inside the embassy. Quote,
"You, the revolutionary members of the Iranian embassy in London, we admire your steadfastness and forbearance against the criminal actions of Iraq, as well as those of the agents of imperialism and international Zionism. The nation and government of Iran are intimately standing beside you. Since it is a fact that the whole of the Iranian nation is prepared for martyrdom for continuity of our glorious revolution and will under no circumstances yield to any kind of force and pressure exerted by imperialism and international Zionism, we feel certain that you are also ready for martyrdom alongside your nation and do not expect the Iranian nation to pay ransom to the agents of world imperialism. You must rest assured that we shall spare no effort for your release, and should you so wish, and if needs be, tens of thousands of Iranians are now ready to enter the premises of the embassy, not with weapons, but with cries of Allahu Akbar, and bring punishment upon those mercenaries of Iraq in a manner they deserve. If the British government fails to solve the situation, we shall take matters into our own hands."
How helpful, Commissioner John Dello commented at the statement. If the Iranians want to send thousands of their citizens to the embassy, then we would be ready for them, and by God, they will reap the whirlwind. This wasn't Dello's only headache at this time, however. The other came in the form of His Royal Highness Prince Andrew, the Queen's 21-year-old son and second in line to the throne. Well, he had been watching the siege on the television news and decided that he wished to visit the scene. The prince would like to visit for lunch, the request came in to Dello. This was the last thing Dello needed, at this tense moment, he thought. A bloody, pompous little out-of-touch prince and his entourage standing around, getting in the way and stuffing their faces with sandwiches. Dello politely denied the royal request on the grounds of safety. Bloody plonker, he muttered under his breath. Mustafa Karkouti, the Syrian journalist being held among the hostages, was increasingly pale and sweating copiously. He'd become increasingly ill throughout the day, and by the evening he was feverish. Salim led Karkouti down the entrance hall, sat him on the lower step, and gave him a glass of water. "We've decided to let you go. We are sorry for all the troubles we have caused you," Salim said gently with his hand on Karkouti's shoulder. Surprised, Karkouti actually protested. "Should you not release one of the women?" Salim shook his head. "No, it's you or no one." "Now?" "Yes, now." And with that, Karkouti walked out of the embassy, the fifth hostage to be freed. It's not clear why Salim chose to let Karkouti go at this point or at all. Even Mustafa Karkouti stated following the siege that he was entirely baffled by this decision. But after 5 days of alarm and standing down, the SAS team were beginning to accept that things would soon be over and they would be returning to barracks. Another operation where they wouldn't be called into action, and another frustrating stand-down. Although the view of the situation inside the embassy was changing again, Salim was becoming increasingly paranoid. He could hear noises in the wall. PC Trevelock was doing his best to put Salim's mind at ease by telling him that it was mice in the walls of the building, or the building cooling down at night. But Salim didn't believe Locke. He thought it was the police. And he was right. The police negotiators heard this exchange between Locke and Salim, so they wanted to deter Salim's thoughts. They called the field telephone to thank Salim for releasing Karkuti. But Salim sounded depressed. He refused food, demanded the ambassadors once again, and then hung up. The situation had now entered a highly unstable phase. The soldiers of the 22nd SAS Regiment were next door to the embassy. They were watching the news discuss the situation involving the American hostages in Tehran, and the failed hostage rescue 10 days earlier by soldiers of the US Delta Force, a team that the SAS regiment knew well. They had been trained by the SAS. There were thoughts going around the soldiers that this siege may end in the same way. Peter de la Billière, the director of the Special Forces, observed, quote, "I felt certain that the siege would end in bloodshed," unquote. Regardless, Operation Nimrod would be a concerted stronghold assault, attacking all floors simultaneously with guns, gas and explosives. It would be, de la Billière thought to himself, the largest peacetime military engagement ever attempted on the British mainland. By the sixth day, the siege was entering a jittery miasma of extreme sleeplessness. The gunmen were depleted of energy, focus and mental acuity. They were sleeping in shifts, but they remained awake most of the time, unable to sleep and extremely nerve-ravaged. Most exhausted of all was Salim. He had slept for a total of around 5 hours across all of the 5 days of the siege thus far. There was no question about it. Salim was close to the edge, paranoid, jumpy and increasingly erratic. Police psychologists analysing the sound captured from inside the embassy feared that Salim could break at any point. Salim took PC Trevelock and Sim Harris to the second floor landing and pointed to the wall adjoining the Ethiopian embassy. The plaster was cracking and the wall was visibly starting to bulge inward. Salim pointed at the wall and exclaimed, "The police are going to attack. The wall was flat yesterday. They're going to come in through the walls." Locke and Harris tried to shrug off the claim as ridiculous, but they could see the cracks and bulging wall themselves and started to wonder what the hell was going on. Salim instructed Mackie to stand guard on the landing. Salim and Faisal then rounded up 17 male hostages and herded them into the second floor telex room, which faced out the front of the building. Desks and chairs were stacked against the windows, along with the two telex machines. All of the women were left in the cipher room at the back of the building where Fauzi was guarding them. The gunmen then, in unison, tied their keffiyehs around their faces. This didn't look good. Salim picked up the field telephone and stated, quote, "We will shoot a hostage in 30 minutes if there is no news about an Arab ambassador." He then hung up the phone. Something had visibly changed in Salim. For all intents and purposes, he appeared to have reached the end of his rope. The leader of the terrorists now seemed entirely detached from what was happening around him. PC Trevelock and the BBC correspondent Sim Harris both sensed this change, and with it an impending fear. Locke tried to reason with Salim. He said, quote, "Look, Salim, there are other alternatives to violence, honourable alternatives. You could honourably surrender to the police and give yourselves up. If you start shooting hostages, that makes you common criminals. It changes the whole game. You have lost the peaceful nature of your cause, and you will lose the sympathy of the British public and the sympathy of the world public. You would have lost everything after gaining so much. Why not end it all now without violence? Show that you mean peace. Walk out of here like a man and show that you mean peace." It was a noble speech by Locke, and filled with many truths, but Salim wasn't interested in hearing any of it. The British police want this, and they want it all to go on forever. They are buying time and plotting to invade. They don't care about you. They don't care if you die, Salim calmly replied, distant, his thoughts elsewhere. I have had enough, he quietly finished. Ali and Abbas were ready to give up, but Faisal ordered them to get a grip of themselves and focus. Maki gave little away. Hassan was ready to kill. At 12:06, Abbas Lavasani raised his hand, asking to go to the lavatory. Ali nodded and escorted him out of the room. Then the other hostages heard raised voices and arguing in Arabic. 20 minutes passed, and Lavasani had still not returned. Salim escorted Locke and Harris down to the ground floor. Lavasani, wearing a distinctive bright yellow cardigan, was stood in the main entrance hall with Faisal and Hassan. He looked somewhat distraught. Faisal had a machine gun cocked and was stood next to Lavasani. Mr. Trevor, tell the police we have brought a hostage downstairs and we will shoot him in 5 minutes unless we get what we want, Salim said to PC Locke. The field telephone had been moved to a table next to them. Lavasani's eyes widened. The realization that he was the hostage with his neck on the line was quickly sinking in. Locke picked up the phone and the negotiator greeted him. Hello? Please, sir, will you understand they intend to shoot a hostage? They have brought one downstairs and he's standing right next to us, Locke said, his voice trembling. Faisal tied Lavasani's hands behind his back and bound his legs together as Locke was talking to the negotiator. Both Locke and Sim Harris knew the situation. Hassan pushed the young Iranian into a sitting position on the bottom step and tied him to the iron spindles of the staircase. As things unfolded, Locke was on the phone trying to give a commentary to the police negotiator. The negotiator too felt that the situation felt more tense than usual. Different. Salim seized the receiver. You've had enough time. If you really cared about someone, then you would be here already. But we are going to shoot one. Salim motioned for Harris and Locke to go back upstairs. Lavasani looked up at PC Locke as he climbed the staircase. His expression was terrified, but his voice was calm. Please don't worry, Mr. Trevor. I'm not afraid to die. Faisal tied a strip of cloth over Lavasani's eyes. Harris and Locke were on the first floor landing when Salim held up the telephone receiver to Lavasani's mouth. My name is Abbas Lavasani. I am tied up and they are going to kill me. Please help me. Salim slammed the phone down, enraged that Lavasani had told the negotiator his name. At 12:55 p.m., Faisal slowly walked up behind Abbas Lavasani and fired 3 bullets at point-blank range into the back of his head. Sim Harris placed his head in his hands, horrified at the sounds of the gunshots ringing out throughout the embassy. The game had now changed. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.